Hi. Thank you for inviting me. This is my first time giving a conference talk, so I'm really nervous, and please excuse me. And I hope that people in the back can see it. Yes, and I'll focus on jet schemes, if I have time at the end, which I think I would with an hour, that I'll talk about truncated wedge schemes, which is a higher dimensional analog. And I'll define all the things that I list up there. This is my thesis work. If I only talk about jet schemes, then it will be part of it. Otherwise, it will be most of it. So I'm going to start with a central question of what I would want to talk about before I actually give any definition. Is it readable? So my goal is, if you give me a singular variety x, what can I say about the scheme structure of these jet schemes? For example, how many components do I have? Can I find a dimension of each of the components? What is the multiplicity of each of the components? And similarly, I want to say similar things for a higher dimension or called the truncated wedge schemes. So the plan and the outline will be, I'll tell you a little bit of history, little things that you need to know about jets, and then I'll go talk about the results that I have on jet schemes and monomic schemes, jet schemes of determinant varieties, and again, if I have time, we'll talk about truncated wedge schemes. So let's start with definition. Given a scheme X of finite type over field K, and for me, my field will be algebraically closed, characteristic is zero. If you want complex numbers, perfect. And MZ is a morphism over K from spite of KT mod T to the n plus 1 to X. And if you take the collection of all these MZs of X, it forms a scheme. Thank you. And I'm going to denote it with script JM of X. So you can think of an MZ as being, you specify a point on your scheme, you're going to give, and then you specify the tangent direction, a second order derivative direction, and so on up to the nth order. And of course, we have the natural suggestion on the ring map that would give me maps on the jet schemes. And in particular, pi m is the one that I'm going to use over and over again. So pi m is going to be the one that goes from jm all the way down to j0. So it's the composition map of pi m, m minus 1. Okay. So let me give you a little bit history of how jets come in. Jets come in actually from arc. And arc is... the K-morphism from a formal power series ring of one variable, psychobats, to X. That's what an arc is. And again, if you take the collection of all the arcs on X, then you get a scheme also, but not Noetherian, because it's not going to be finally generated and pretty chaotic. So you can view a jet as a truncation of an arc. Right? So if I take all those maps, let's see, let's give it a name. So the collection of all the arcs of X is called the arc space of X, not surprising. And it's going to be denoted by J infinity of X. We won't talk about arcs too much, but, and you can see that, so tin J infinity, you can get the inverse limit of all the arc space JM of X. So that's the relationship between arcs and jets. So why do I talk about arcs? Because arcs come first, apparently, since the first series study is carried out by Nash in the 60s. So he was thinking about, well, can the singularities of a variety X be reflected in the R space. If you know the R space or some properties of R space, can you tell what kind of singularities you have or certain of that type? And then it kind of becomes kind of quiet after a little while, and then Konsevich started again, talk about jet skins and R spaces by his introduction of motivic integration. If none of these words means to you, anything to you, that's okay. And then of course Dinav and Loser and Bhattiret, they go ahead and do more on motivic integration. But then as the Russian started, Merchant Mostasser and his collaborators, Robert Lotterfeld, Ein, they started something different. They want to study singularities again, and now they're asking, instead of this relationship with R space, can you tell about its jet space? If you take the truncated, can you say something? If you know for all M some properties of JM, can you say something about the singularities of your variety that you start off with? And so they use contact loci, all this high-tech, really high-tech math to me of studying all these topological properties. But to me, it seems like, well, there's not really any examples carried out. People talk about it. People use these fancy terminologies. But when you really ask them, like, so what's the picture of it? They're like, I don't have a picture. So that's the motivation of my work. It's also, I follow my advisor's work. They started it first, and then I sort of pick up from it. So that's my motivation for jets. But let's look at examples first. So if you take M to be zero, well, let's go down a little bit. So if you take M to be zero, then what you're just taking an M jet or zero jet would be map on spec K to X. Well, so you just, if you take a collection of all those, you get all the points you have on X. So you recover X. So J0 is X. What is J1? Well, it's all the maps from spec KT mod T squared to X. Well, that's the total tangent space of X, right? Then you can ask, well, so maybe J2, J3, they're all really simple. You can just, you know, maybe we already have names for them. So let's look. If you start with just the affine space, good old innocent one, AR, I want to know what an M jet of X is. Well, I think algebraically. So algebraically is the K algebra homomorphism from the coordinate ring of spec of X to KT mod T to the M plus 1. That's what an M jet is. Well, so how do I specify this homomorphism? Of course, for each variable, I specify what its image is. I define it, right? So I'm going to define the image to be xi 0, xi 1, all the way up to xi m, or t to m. I've used that notation over and over again. So that's one m jet. If you took the collection of all those, then you can think of it as, well, there's no relation on the xi, and therefore there's no relations on the xij. And so I can identify the M jet scheme of X of the affine space to be just a spec of a huge polynomial ring. Right? I say it's big because R could be big, M could be really big. So you're dealing with just a huge affine space again. Maybe I'll leave the definition up there. Alright, so far so good. Well, what if I don't have an affine space? What's the next thing that I can look at? Well, you can look at just spec of kxy mod xy. Right, so it's just the union of the x and y s's. And mjet again corresponds to a k-algebra homomorphism from kxy mod xy to kt mod t n plus 1, again, specify what x tends to, y tends to. But this time, I do have a relation, right? X times y is 0, so this image, this product of this two polynomial has to be 0, which tells me that, well, if I multiply all out, right, so, and once I multiply all out, mod t to the n plus 1, I'm more or less sort of thinking about, I'm working as a polynomial, in a polynomial ring. I need it to be 0, that means that all the coordinates of t to the I, for all I, have to be 0, right? And therefore, my jet scheme Jm of x is defined by a deal which I'm going to call just regular Jm. And here are the generators. G0 is the zero, is the constant term, x0 times y0. G1 is the coefficient of t all the way up to gm. But remember that we're still modeling out by t to the m plus 1. So you can imagine that, well, if you take kxyz mod out by x times y times z, you have similar things. Except that the generators, of course, would be more complicated, more terms. But you can work it out if you want. You can just write it out. So it's not too bad. So after looking at these examples, then let's look at jet schemes of monomial schemes. So by monomial scheme, I mean a scheme that is defined by a monomial ideal in a polynomial ring. That's what I mean. So there are many kinds of monomial ideal you can take. What is the simplest thing I can take? Well, I can take a reduced, meaning square free. I can take a hypersurface, meaning my ideal is just generated by one generator. So let's start with that. So suppose I take x to be spy of k x1 through xn modeled by x1 through xr. So of course r is less than or equals to n. Then well, it sits inside an, so therefore the mth jet scheme of x sits inside the mth jet scheme of an, which we know was spec of a huge polynomial ring, right? And again, I'm defining the ideal to be Jm. So first thing that I have, result with, not me, but I have something followed, is that Russell Garrett and my advisor, Kevin Smith, they started this, and they were like, well, what can you ask? So remember the central questions. The first thing I asked was, how many components do you have? In other words, well, since I'm only dealing with affine varieties, I'm asking, well, how many minimal primes do you have? They do a better job of just not only answering that, but they have a description of all the minimal primes. It turns out to be really, really nice. So X is that monomial scheme that we start. Then they actually find out that all the minimal primes have this form, x1, 0 up to x1, t1, minus 1, and so on. I'm allowing, if the ti say t1 is 0, then that means that all the x1s do not come into picture, so you have no x1s in your prime. And the only thing that governs it is that the sum of ti has to be equals to n plus 1. That's the only condition on it. So you can write out a bunch of them. So that's nice. Well, you have minimal primes being just generated by variables in this new polynomial ring, right? What's the next thing you can ask? Well, you can ask, all right, now you, so you know how many components there are, because you can count how many minimal primes there are. You also know what is the dimension of each of them, right? And so then the next thing you can ask is, well, what is the multiplicity of each of the components then? That's another thing you can ask about the scheme structure. And that's where my work starts. So I found out that if you take the same scheme, X, then a multiplicity along each of the component P has this really simple form. I call it a multinomial coefficient. It's just n plus 1 factorial divided by the product of all the factorial TIs. So that's really nice. And then the next thing I ask is, well, can I say something more? All this has only to do with basically, I mean, the middle point has to do with reduced structures and everything. So I want to know some more. I want to know some more about the scheme structure. What's the next thing I can do? Well, primary decomposition. I want to know not just the irreducible components, but also the primary components. And that turns out to be terrible. I only take just two variables. Stay with the easy case, spec kxy mod x times y. The only primary components I can actually give a description is either when, so the first two cases is really nice. P is either generated by all the x or generated by all the y's. So the primary component is itself. Reason being, so let's think. You have, your x is the union of the x and y axis, right? So the first minimal prime corresponds to the component sitting over the y axis, right? When y axis is x equals 0. And then the next thing corresponds to the component sitting over the x axis. But here you have a singularity at the origin. And already, so all the other minimal primes sit over this origin. And you're trying to get a description of them. And it's really, really terrible. So what I did was, I was like, okay, Macaulay, you can do the work for me. You can generate all the primary components. And then I stare at them for months and then try to come up with a description. So I took all the, you know, different M's. I try to come up with a conjectural, you know, possible description. And I was able to do it only when you add in either one x or one y. At least I got a pattern. Then I go, well, okay, I have to prove it. I can't just say, well, Macaulay did it, and, you know, here you go, here's the pattern. So I have to go through this long process of, well, let's check that, you know, maybe the generators of this primary component actually is a Grobner basis. I check that. Well, it is, all good. So then I go about, and okay, now I have a Grobner basis, that's a little bit better. I can do a membership check. It's all brute force. And I was like, well, you know, if I can do it for one, maybe I can do it for the second one, right? So I started Macaulay and I said, okay, I look at all the data again. If I put in two X or two of the Ys, what happened? Well, I studied for like 2 months. I could not find a pattern. It's just simply, anytime I thought, oh, I have a pattern, I generate the next case to check. Nope, it's not. Work on it some more. Oh, I have another pattern. Work on it. Nope, check it, next case. Still false. So after a while, I'm like, you know, it's too hard. I give up. Let's work on something else. Maybe I don't really want to work on this, you know, reduced monomial hypersurface case. Well, so I thought, what's the next thing I can do? Well, I can take away the reduced part. I can look at something that is not reduced. But what's the first thing not reduced I can look at? How about a fat point in the affine line? It's the simplest thing I can think of. And Goward and Smith from the previous case, they already tell me what the minimum primes would be. It turns out I only have one. I only have one component. Well, that's good. I don't have as many to work out. And again, it's very nice. It's, the minimum prime is generated by just variables. So I know that it's irreducible, one component. So, and of course, then I know what the dimension is. So, of course, same thing, next question. What is the multiplicity? I didn't ask that question. I somehow got this question from Ayn. I don't know what exactly he was doing at that time, but he asked around to see, well, you know, did people actually compute multiplicity for jet skins? And I was working on my stuff, so he was like, oh, why don't you work on this? I was like, okay. So he asked, what is the multiplicity of the order of jet, or the m's jet skin for x, if x is just fat k small x to the n? That's what I mean by a fat point in the affine line. First thing I do, talking to Macaulay, ask it, is, you know, give it to me. Just tell me what it is. Of course, I have to trick it, because it doesn't know how to localize. So I have to trick it by sort of inverting some of the elements, and there you go, of course. And then I have to check it by hand to make sure that, you know, I actually have inverted enough elements. And here's my conjecture. I believe it's a binomial coefficient, which is not too surprising because in the previous case, I have a multinomial coefficient. So it's not too bad. I have a binomial. And then I'm like, well, okay, I see a pattern. And then, well, go ahead, prove it. Well, I have a really hard time proving it at first. But I'll show you some of the data that I have from a colleague and that I have verified. that some of them at least seems to hold. And so, well, what did I do? Well, I started proving it. Not very far. I can prove it when m is less than n. I can prove it when, so maybe I took it down so you can see all the, I can prove it if m is congruent to minus 1 mod n. I cannot prove it when m is congruent to minus 2 mod n. I get a lower bound. I get exactly what I want as a lower bound. And I thought, well, an upper bound can't be that bad. It should be the lower bound that is hard. But I after months, I'm like, you know, I need to write up my thesis. And here are the results. I'll work on it later. So I love it if anybody wants to work on it. And you have to prepare to have this crazy number of generators and for the ideal and just huge number of variables. All right. So after working on monomial schemes for a while, I'm like, well, okay, I'm kind of sick of it. Because the very first non-reduced case, I can't even do it all. And so I'm like, well, let's switch to something else. And I got a suggestion, well, why don't you work on determinant of varieties? I'm like, okay, that sounds good. Started on it. So if you don't know, you should all know, right, because from the first week. But if you don't know what a determinant variety is, that's what I mean. So if you take the set of all alpha S matrices of rank at most C over a field K, again, my field is always algebraically closed, curiously zero. You can think of XC, my determinant variety, is the closed algebraic set in the alpine space ALS defined by the ideal IC plus 1, which is all the C plus 1 minus, right? Because that's what it means by a rank at most C. What are some of the properties of determinant varieties? Well, you know exactly what the dimension is. It's very simple. You also know that it's Cohen Macaulay and normal. Pretty nice. If R equals to S, that is the generic matrix you start off with a square matrix, you get a Gorenstein variety. And the singular locus is just all the ones that have rank at most C minus 1. So one level down. And it has rational singularities. So not too bad. Maybe I'll start here. So first question I ask, of course I want to know, well, here I have a scheme X is singular. I want to look at a jet scheme sitting over it. And I ask, first thing, are they irreducible? Some work has been done. Merchant Mostasa in 2001 tells me that, well, if R equals to S equals to C plus 1, so you have actually a complete intersection, you have a hyperservice in that case. So then all its jet skins are irreducible. So you have a fixed X, you vary M, and it's going to be that all the JM of X are irreducible. And in particular, if you take the variety 2 by n matrices, so if you take R to be, say, 2, S is n, and you take C to be 1, then it also has irreducible jet schemes. Well, not bad. Then the next thing I ask, well, is it possible that all the jet schemes of all the determinant varieties are irreducible? What's your guess? No, it's too ideal. I mean, it would be true if the world is perfect, but it's not. So I have to find out, well, which are the ones that are irreducible or which are the ones that are reducible, one way or the other, right? So I guess one. I'm going to pause on that. What is the situation? Okay. So I'm not going to tell you the answer yet, but I'll tell you what kind of strategies. Yes. Yes. Yes, if you have rational singularities. Yeah, so his theorem was stronger. What he said was if you start with a locally complete intersection, then it has rational singularities if and only if all the jet schemes are irreducible. So in here, like I told you earlier, that because the domain varieties have rational singularities, then and because I take a particular special case that is a hypersurface already, then you have it. But in So I'm going to first sort of describe to you what is the strategy. So my goal is not to find something that is irreducible, because that's too hard. I want to find the determinant varieties where the jet schemes are reducible. Right? So here's the idea. So remember that we have our x, and here we have our jm of x, right? And the map was pi m. What I was calling it. So, well, here x is singular, so of course I can write it as the disjoint unit of the singular locus as well as the smooth locus. Right? So, if I want to understand what Jm of x is, I could try to understand what is the pullback of these two parts. Right? What is the preimage? If I understand that, then maybe I have a chance to actually understand what Jm of x could be. So, let's see. If you take the smooth locus, it's open. Right, so I can pull it back. Suppose here it goes. Now pull it back. I'm going to close it inside Jm of x. Right, so now I have something that's closed. And so it will contribute. So this, already known that this, the guy, always contributes one component to Jm of x. But I want to get something that's reducible, so I want to get at least two components. How is that possible? Well, I also have the pullback of the singular locus, right? The singular locus is closed, so the preimage is already closed. So how is it possible that I can get at least two components? If this guy sits somewhere but not completely inside, then I get at least two. Agree? So if this closed set sits inside, then, well, this is the component that you have. You don't have anything else. But if it somehow does not completely contain it, then you get at least two components. It won't tell you how many, but at least you know that it's not irreducible. So the goal is that if I want to show that it's reducible, that Jm of x is reducible, then I need to show that the dimension of pi m inverse, I guess I've changed notation. If it's at least the dimension of the closure of the preimage of the smooth locus, then I'm good. Again, it does not tell you how many components, but at least it tells you you have more than one. All right, so that's the strategy. That's what I was trying to aim for. So I'm like, okay, let's start. This is fine. Okay. So first thing I tried was, suppose you take the determinant variety of R by S matrices of rank at most C. C is at least 1. I have to put in a condition that R and S is at least C plus 2, and R plus S is greater than or equal to C plus 5. So I've missed the ones that are just at the margin. Then I found that the jet scheme JM is reducible for M being odd. So J1, J3, J5, I know that they have at least two components. Right? And so if I do the case, notice that I did not allow R and S to be both C plus 2, right? That's the case that I've omit by putting the condition of R plus S. But Macaulay sort of tells me that it gives me evidence that I believe even those marginal cases are reducible. However, the strategy that I want does not work because the dimension would be either equal or smaller. So that doesn't tell me anything. Right? Just because that strategy doesn't work, it doesn't mean that it's going to be irreducible. So I think I have time to sort of tell you something that I've used for that. Can I actually compute it? No, not in a general case. No. The reason being that, well, if the number C is big, then a singular locus is actually very big, and I have no control of it at all. So no, I don't know what its dimension at all. The only thing I can tell is whether it's reducible or irreducible. I would like to know, but so far I have not managed. So how would I try to prove something like this? I need something that is fairly general. If you start with a smooth scheme X, and let's see, Z sitting inside Y, sitting inside X, these are all closed. Okay. Then what I would know is that the dimension of pi Pm minus 1 inverse of Z is at least P times dimension of pi M minus 1 inverse of Z. And this is for all P and M minus 1. So in my case, I'll be taking X to be the big upper space ALF, and my Y would be my determinant of variety, XC, and Z is the singular locus. So what it tells me is this lemma would allow me to compute the dimension of something that is big, so when Pm minus 1 is big, so it would tell me that it has some relationship with that. So in particular, well, I use it when, well, of course, I use it when m is 2. Right. So if I know what is the dimension of pi 1 inverse of the singular locus, then this lemma would tell me that at least I have a lower bound for the dimension of pi 2p minus 1, all the odd ones. Right. So as you can imagine, then, well, of course, then I'm doing the induction. When I'm proving the theorem, I'm doing the induction on m. Right. And to prove this, you need to know about contact loci and everything. It's too complicated for me to say it here. All right, so I was like, well, okay, so now at least with the condition I have to put on R and S, but at least I know what's happening for all the odd jet scheme. Well, next thing, of course, I want to know about the even, right? And it would be really nice if I can use the same lemma. But whatever M I can take here, it doesn't really help me a lot, right? So suppose I know about J2. Suppose I know what is the dimension. So if I take M to be 3, suppose I know this dimension, right? What can I take here that will help me with the high even ones? Not very much. So I thought, well, I need another strategy. I need something else, not this lemma, but something slightly different. And I tried and I tried and I tried. I failed. I can do it, but I could do it for J2. Again, I need to put on some conditions on what R and S could be, but at least within that conditions, then I know that J2 is also reducible. So this gives a huge number of like the jet schemes of the minimum varieties that at least not irreducible. I don't get it all, certainly. And again, it seems from a colleague that I think the marginal cases are the same, but the dimension thing that the strategy that I outlined, it doesn't work. So I need something different. So this one is mostly just brute force. Basically just sort of, it's J2, so it's not terrible. You can just sort of brute force and do it, argue about it. So I thought, well, maybe I'm being a little bit too ambitious. Maybe I just shouldn't look at when rank is so big. Well, what's the smallest rank that I can also look at? How about 1? That I can do. So if you take the determinant of variety of rank at most 1, and again I assume R is at least R is greater than S greater than equal to 3, because otherwise the previous cases have been done by Nastassov's theorem. Then here I got a lot better. Not only do I know, so from the first theorem there, you already know that you have reducible for some of them. But I can pinpoint a little bit better. I can tell you exactly how many irreducible components I have. I can tell you the dimension. But I do not go by, so one thing you can guess is, well, maybe I actually have a description of the minimal primes. Right, that's what previously has been done. If you can actually give a description of the minimal primes, well, there you go. You can count all this stuff. No, I cannot. I don't know what the minimal primes are. I think they're terrible looking. But I can do this by induction. And I need something special. So it's special that I actually take the rank to be at most 1, because if I take this determinant variety, what is the singular locus? Well, it's all the R by S matrices of rank at most 0. Well, what's that? It's a 0 matrix, right? It's the best thing you can hope for. It's just the origin. That's the only singularity you can have. So you have some control of what the pullback will be, and that's the only reason that I can get that. If you take at most 2, already I'm lost, because now your singularity set is a lot bigger. It's not just a point. And to do that, you can use something that I thought was kind of nice. Here we go. So again, it's a more general lemma, but I'll apply it in our special case. So if you have something sitting inside AN, it's a closed subscheme. But not any closed subscheme. It has to be defined by a set of homogeneous polynomials. And not only do they have to be homogeneous, they have to be homogeneous of the same degree. Say D. Then you know exactly, precisely, what's the preimage of the origin. It's Jn minus D of the same scheme you started with X, but crossed with an alpine space. So with this description of what is the preimage of the singular locus, then, well, so I, of course, then I do an induction on the M here, right? So if I know how many components here I have, then I just have to check the dimension of all those components with the ones I have extra, add up, next case. So like I said, this is the only good case you can have. Singular origin, you're good. Otherwise, I don't know what happened. I don't know how to do the analysis at all, trying to find dimension or anything. So I would love to know other things, like not just that they're reducible, but how many components I actually have, and if possible, what is dimension. Right. So without knowing any of those, in other words, so I of course also want to jump into the multiplicity thing, but that will require me to actually have a description of the minimal primes, which in this determinant variety case is not particularly nice. Yes. Mm-hmm. No, I'm only saying that if you only pull back the origin, so X could be very singular, it could be singular at other points, or it could be really big. I'm only saying that I only know that the preimage of 0 is this. It doesn't matter of what kind of singularity you have. Right. Other questions? So what's the one good thing from this theorem? That, well, I restrict a lot. I'm only looking at when C is 1. But one good thing I can have is I can calculate something called the log canonical threshold. If you know a little bit about multiply ideals or anything like that, so the log canonical threshold is the first jumping number. And in general, it's not easy to compute. But in my case, so the what I know is that, so Mostafa gave this theorem that tells you if you want to find a Lacanau threshold, if you can find out what is the dimension of each of your jet schemes for all m, then it has a formula that tells you what the Lacanau threshold would be. And in this case, it's exactly half the dimension of the ambient space. Woohoo, I still have 20 minutes. All right. So far we talk about jets. And then the natural question occurred to me was, why do I only care about, so remember that, do I have it? So remember that the definition for the jet is that you take an M jet is the K morphism from stack KT mod T to the N plus 1, right? So to me, the natural thing is, why just one variable T? Why can't I do two variables? Maybe S, T, or three variables? Or do I actually have to stick with modding out by the obvious, the power of the obvious maximum ideal? I could do, maybe I could do spec of K, S, T mod S to the A, T to the B. Why not? It seems natural to me to consider such a thing. And surely some people have talked about it. So I guess I'm going to let it stay up there. This one. So I'm going to do the first kind. Again, you take a scheme, finite type over a field. An M wedge is a K-morphism, so it's a high-dimensional analog. As you can see, I'm only taking instead of one variable, I'm taking two variables. And as the previous case, if you take the collection of all these M wedges, it forms a scheme. And same thing, So remember that I sort of said that an M jet was a truncation of an arc, right? You can do the same. So an M wedge is a truncation of what they call a wedge. So you just take two variables, or spec of the power series ring of two variables. Then there you go, then M wedge is just truncation. Well, here I have a whole new different thing. Well, now I switch from one variable to two variables. I have a price to pay. Because if you talk about an arc, you have a PID. So there are many things that happen there. If I choose two variables, I have a UFD, but I don't have a PID anymore, which creates the problem. For example, so if you talk about jets or arcs, if you have a proper bi-directional map, it lifts. If you have an arc or jet down here, you lift. With wedges or M wedges, they don't. Most of the time, they don't. Then you have a huge problem with it. But I still want to study it. I still want to see if there's anything besides that. Is there anything that maybe looks relatively okay for M wedges? And I find out that actually, it's not too bad. It's just some properties with jets, not everything, but some of the good ones. For example, if you take an A-time morphism from X to Y, finite type, then the M wedge WM of X is isomorphic to the product M WM of Y cross X over Y. So the thing, that has already known, if you change all the W into J, that's known. What's good about A-time morphisms is it tells you in a way that if you sort of know things about affine or sort of local things, then you can possibly sort of talk about it globally. So one of the sort of the kind of corollary you have is if you start with a smooth scheme, only if you start with a smooth scheme X of a certain dimension, say N, then the nth wedge of X is locally an affine bundle over X. In particular, then your M wedge is smooth, and you know exactly what its dimension is. So similar statements for jets is known, the dimension is different. But at least that tells me something good, because if I want to sort of say, do something like before, if I want to look at just a smooth locus, and I put it back, then at least I know what that thing, after I close it, what that thing may look like. At least I know it's smooth. So something less to worry about. And remember that when we first talk about jets, oh, there it is. So J1 was the total tension space of X. And it turns out that W1 is not bad. W1 is J1 cross J1. Well, of course, you can't expect it to be J1, because otherwise it would be the same thing, and definitely that's not going to be. But at least you have a description of what it should be. So again, same thing. Well, okay, so I have a nice description of what W1 would be. Can I ask for W2 maybe? Maybe W2 is like J2 cross J2 over X or over J1, or a combination of other things. But doing a very simple dimension count, I already know that that's, even if I take X to be smooth, for example, something doesn't quite happen. I don't seem to know what kind of pattern it would be. I do kind of think that it should have a pattern, like that WM should somehow be related to JM. I'm not sure how that will work for higher M. Another property that I found was, so again, Mertram and Stossel have this saying that if you start with a local complete intersection, then he gives an irreducible criterion for the jet schemes. And I want to do something similar, so I go ahead and sort of study the proof and say, well, can I borrow it for wedges? Surely enough, not too hard. So the statement tells you, if you start with a locally complete intersection, then the scheme WM is pure dimensional if only if the dimension satisfies equality. And in that case, then you also actually get a local complete intersection for your wedge scheme, for your M's wedge scheme. And it's irreducible if only if the dimension of the pullback of the singular locus. You already know what is the dimension of the pullback of the smooth locus, right, from the affine bundle property. So that's the only sort of restriction. So after all this sort of simple work, I'm like, well, okay, I sort of want to go back to what I started, right? So first thing what I start with studying the jet schemes of monomial schemes. So I want to do the same thing. Can I study the nth wedge scheme of a monomial scheme? So again, I want to start with monomial scheme. Of course, you can guess. I start with something. I play with reduced monomial hypersurface first, and I sort of go on and sort of try to do other cases. Maybe I should find the other one so you can actually see the relationship between the two things if I can find it. Oh, there we go. So they give a description of the minimal primes. I want to do the same thing. I want to give a description of the minimal primes. And as you can see, there are a lot of similarities. Both of them, all the minimal primes are generated by only variables. Mine, of course, is a lot worse. So when I say xk to the ik, jk, so I guess maybe I should define my notation. So when I think of a mjet, say I was doing kxn mod something, so I would send my xi, if you can guess, well, I'll be xi 0, 0, plus xi 1, 0 of s, 0, 1, t, and so on. So the ik is the power of s, and the jk is the power of t. Right, so the same thing, you can write out exactly what it would be, write out. So again, I have identified my scheme as an ideal in a huge, even bigger polynomial ring. So I thought, hey, that's quite nice. It seems like there is a real analog between the two things. The minimal prime seems to behave more or less the same way. And so I was like, well, okay, that's actually good. So again, if you take all the AI to be one, which is the case that the special case that I listed there, then you exactly know what are the minimum primes. So you know the dimension of the components, irreducible components, and you know how many of them there are. Next thing, multiplicity. The last time what I had was I have for multinomial coefficient. And I was really, really surprised. When I asked my colleague to start and also do it by hand, somehow I found that the multiplicity of a reduced monomial hypersurface, it seems that along any irreducible component is 1. I'm not claiming that Wm is reduced at all. That's not what I'm claiming. I'm only claiming that the multiplicity is 1. In other words, there's possible primary components, there are possible primary units, and it seems the way that it is, but I don't know for sure. Again, Macaulay seems to tell me that such a thing happens, but I don't know how to prove such a thing. I could prove it when R is 2. I could prove it when R is 3. And it's really funny because you have these huge generators that are really chaotically looking. But what I could actually do is, so how would you try to show that something has multiplicity 1 after localization? Well, you could, one of the things that I could do is, I can take actually a subset of the generators and already show that after localization at that prime that I want, they actually already generate a maximal ideal. So actually they form a regular sequence in there. Then it tells me that multiplicity is 1. I have not think of any other way possible. So I have to be really smart about picking my generators. So I have a pattern of how I can pick generators when R is 2 to do my job. I can do a similar thing for R equals to 3. And I thought, well, maybe the same pattern would hold. And well, of course not. I keep sort of trying and trying and trying, and every time I thought I have a pattern again, they fell to the next case. And then later I thought, you know, even if I actually have a pattern, it doesn't really help because after I actually select them, I have to do an analysis on them. And so even somehow I can find a pattern for any R, the analysis will be like exponentially terribly long afterwards. So I can't really hope that such kind of strategy would work eventually. But I would love to see even a lower bound or upper bound using other methods of trying to get the multiplicity. I mean, so of course, well, there you go. It's a lower bound, it's 1, right? But I want to get an upper bound that, you know, you can have something more than that. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.